Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. Today is Thursday, February 19th. I'm Richard Benulli, your host, and today we have Dr. Mark Faber, Ira Harris, and Judd Hirschberg. Dr. Faber is the editor and publisher of the Gloom, Boom, and Doom Report, which highlights unusual investment opportunities. It's a great publication. I'm a subscriber, and I learn immensely from the insights. Dr. Faber is the author of several books and well-known for his contrarian investment approach. Ira is past hedge fund manager and global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He served as CME director from 1997 to 2003 and also in 2019. We also have today chief investment strategist Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading Strategies to help form the basis of some of the discussion with his charts and technical analysis indicators. Welcome, gentlemen. Great. I thought we'd begin, Dr. Faber, with your macro view on the global economy and the financial markets.
Well, you know, the world is a big place and some countries are doing quite well and some countries are going into recession or into a massive slowdown, and some countries are printing more money and some countries are printing less money, but they all seem to be printing money in one way or the other. And commodity prices, whether the economy is strong or not, have been sort of rising. Not all of them, some have been retreating. But if I look here at, say, crude oil, it's up 15% this year. Gold is 16% and silver 9% this year. And so there has been a lot of volatility. And what I suspected would happen has occurred, namely that in 2025, we reached sort of a great rotation in the world, in the sense that for the first time in like 15 years, the US stock market underperformed European markets and especially emerging markets. I mean, many emerging markets were up more than 30%, adjusted for the dollar, because the dollar was weak. So part of the appreciation of emerging markets was due to the dollar weakness and the strength of the emerging market currencies. In Thailand, everybody was baffled that the Thai baht went up by something like 10% last year against the US dollar. This year, in the first 2 months of the year, I mean, in January and February, the market is up almost 20%. So people have been really surprised because they considered Thailand to be a failed state. And yet the stock market and the currency were very strong. And my sense is that some markets have become relatively pricey. They're still cheaper than the U.S., but they're not terribly cheap as I like to buy. But other markets like Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand, Vietnam are still rather inexpensive and could have another, say, 10 to 20% move this year. So if you add the dividends to it, you're talking about a return of around 25% total return for 2026. But in general, I'm cautious about equities. I think we're sort of in la-la land, and investors are extremely complacent or just piling in into stuff they have little idea about. And my concern is that we have geopolitical trouble around the corner. I mean, right now, some people think the U.S. is about to attack Iran, and if that happened, it would obviously have an impact on raw material, commodity prices, and on financial assets.
Any elaboration on that in case of that potential for a war, like which direction the equities and commodities would move and for how long?
Well, I suspect that oil would continue to go up, probably massively, because the short positions in the futures market are high. And it's likely that any war would be negative for the bond market, that bonds, maybe they'd rally a day or two, but eventually they'll go down. And a war would lead to more inflation. That's at least in the past, major inflation bursts were associated with war times. And I can't imagine that the war would be terribly positive for stocks. But the argument for owning stocks rather than cash would be that in a wartime scenario, the Fed and other central banks would unquestionably print more money. So maybe in nominal terms, you would have equities going up. But in real terms, and here I have to specify real terms, is not in another currency, because all currencies are poor. But in gold, silver, and platinum, expressed in platinum and gold, the market is actually down since 2000 in the US and in other countries as well. And as you know, this year we're about flat on the Dow Jones, but gold is up 15%. So the pattern of money printing, yes, but a downdraft in the purchasing power of the dollar is also existing in existence, because it's reflected in the increase in the price of gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting and very good observations. Your thoughts, Ira? Are you aligned? Well, yeah, with this.
Yeah, very much aligned. and I'm glad Dr. Faber was talking about gold, because I keep going back and looking at and as many others are now looking at it, the gold oil ratio, as they call it. And the ones, you know, the only reason that the gold oil ratio really interests me is because I go back to 1973. And I know Dr. Faber was me.
You're disclosing my age.
Sorry. But no, I do that with the ultimate respect. To 73, Dr. Faber was already working in finance. I was just studying it and theoretically. But as the Marxists, and of which I read quite a bit back then, would discuss, you know, the issue in 73, especially with the Yom Kippur War, as it is called, the OPEC nations, which were a very powerful cartel, they understood that they were on the short side of the stick, so to speak, because oil prices were, what, $2, $2.25 a barrel. The dollar, once Nixon on August 15th, 1971, pulls the plug on the dollar gold exchange, as Jacques Roof would call it, that they knew they were on the short end. So then oil prices jump. What, to $10, $11, $12, whatever the number sets in at. And Now the OPEC nations were awash in money. But there was a gold ratio back then too, because, well, gold had come off the fixed price of 41 and a quarter, 42 and a quarter. So they then started to benefit. But if you go back and look to see what that ratio was then, gold to oil, so when it was, they were on the much better side of the coin. Today, with the gold oil ratio at $80 a barrel, oil producers and exporters are really getting the short side of the coin. And it's not, and we can't forget that, you know, the House of Saud, and many other, the Russians, they are gold holders very much too. So they cannot be very enamored with the 80 to 1 ratio, the 78 to 1 ratio. So let's see how, I don't have a way to say how this is going to be resolved, but let's look at what, that, when we talked about what Trump's move is, and not just Trump, but the, what the White House is going to decide, and along probably bringing with the Israelis, but what can they do? I mean, there's no question Iran, the government of Iran is a little shaky, more than a little shaky at this time. If you wanted to bring it to its knees, the only way to me is to absolutely destroy their oil production infrastructure. But with that, the Iranians will, to their last breath, then it's not to me to go after Israel, but to rather go after the Gulf nations and destroy their oil infrastructure. So you can wind up here in a very, very bad situation. And it plays badly for Trump, because they're playing to the November elections. And one of the things that they shout loudest about is how low oil, gasoline prices are at the pump, right? It's one of the really fear. So that will dissolve in a minute. Dissolve in a minute. And as Dr. Faber says, what'll bond prices do? And that assumes, do we get Kevin Warsh? We don't even know that we're going to get Kevin Warsh in a timely fashion, because Senator Tillis may not let this out. So we got a lot of things going on here, but one of the strengths, so Trump is kind of caught in this situation, because again, if they were, you know, what is it, Kirk Island, and if they go after that infrastructure, I would most certainly believe that the Iranians will go after the infrastructure of the Saudis and the other nations. So we can really wind up here in a very, very bad situation quickly.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, speaking, going back to the ratios you mentioned, can you elaborate, Dr. Faber, on the difference between nominal returns versus real returns on equities? You alluded to, you know, relative to like a basket of precious metals or commodities, how we've really been in a bear market in recent years in that regard. Can you elaborate in more detail? A lot of people don't understand that difference.
Well, first of all, I want to add to Ira's comments that, of course, the price of oil compared to the price of gold is extremely low at the present time. I mean, this has to be said. It's like the price of agricultural products. Some like coffee and cocoa went up, but they came down again. But in general, just about anything in the commodity space is very low compared to gold. Now, some people conclude that therefore gold is overpriced and so forth. I'm not sure. We may be in an unusual situation, but that oil is very, very low, as Ira pointed out, is true. And also the allocation of money to oil equities and energy equities and related is also extremely low, say, compared to technology. So I think that actually investors should increase their exposure to energy stocks. I have bought some more oil companies which I think are reasonably priced because you get a dividend yield of, say, around 5%. And my view is that I like to play the defensive stocks at the present time. Now, as to your question about nominal and real returns, the issue is the following. Say, we are in a country like Zimbabwe, which is the model of Mr. Bernanke's economic model. In that country, you print money. So when you print money, assets in your country will go up. Say the price of real estate will go up, the price of stocks will go up, the price of everything will go up. Also, the cost of living will go up. But what goes down is the currency. Provided the other countries do not print money at the same rate or don't print money at all. Now, in today's world, all the central banks print more or less money. The Swiss probably less than the others, but they also do. But what is not printed is gold and silver and platinum. Now, the quantity that exists in the world increases by the mining output. But we can measure the mining output. And in the last few years, it's been going down. And the discoveries of new mines is at a historic low. So I don't want to be kind of perceived as a gold bug. But I think someone who doesn't own any precious metals is making a mistake. And it seems that a lot of people are making mistakes. Because if you go around the world, let's say you and Ira and me, we may have a substantial exposure to gold, say. If you have, say, $10 million, for sure we would have, say, 10-20% of that, 1-2 million in gold, so around 10-20%. The gold box, they have 80% in gold. And my view was always to hold around 25% of your assets in gold. But if you go to cocktail parties around New York and so forth, and Munich and London and Paris and Madrid, people will tell you, yeah, we own gold. Yes. And then you dig a little bit deeper. Yes, we inherited an earring from our grandmother or something like that. But most people don't have large gold holdings. They own maybe five. I mean, a portfolio manager around the world, he will have an asset allocation of, say, 3-5% in gold, and in the U.S. much less. Now, in Asia, the situation is a bit different because it has a more of a culture of gold, especially, say, in countries like Vietnam. People had their savings in gold because the currency was useless and still is. But the point I'm trying to make, if you look around the world, how people hold their assets, the number one asset for most people is actually real estate. As soon as a family has some money, they buy a motorcycle so they can go to work, and then they buy a car so they can send their children to school, and then they buy a life insurance company and so on, the policy. But most people have no clue about the stock market. And so with their savings, what they understand is real estate. And they will understand easily that gold looks nicer than, say, copper on your arm wrist. And so they buy some gold and they store gold and they see it go up against the currencies. And so they buy more and so forth. But is for most people, it's not the number one asset. And in the developed countries like the US and Europe, especially in the US, number one asset aside from real estate are stocks. Poor people don't own any stocks, but they own maybe a little bit of stocks through the pension funds and so forth, indirectly. But if we look at, and the other thing about gold, most people sold their gold. As gold started to go up, all the technical analysts say that correction is coming at 2000 and so forth. And they kept on selling gold, and so they don't have much at the present time, in my view. Now, Mr. Hirschberg may be able to comment about the technical picture of gold, but I'm telling you, when I travel around and I go to parties and so forth, very few people have a substantial holding in gold and silver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great points. And your thoughts, Ira, on that?
So unlike in the, you know, people talk about the hunts, you know, with what they did with the silver, we're in a totally different world. whoever pushes this is far bigger, and they don't need to leverage it up. They could leverage it up. So we're kind of, well, who's been pushing the gold? Is it sovereign wealth funds who have enormous, enormous number and also know how to use leverage, but they're not going to get a margin call. That much I can guarantee you. Who is it? You know, everyone talks about the central banks. But again, yes, of course, they've been buying. The Polish central bank's been buying, and we know other Eastern Europeans have been adding to their gold reserves. I don't believe that the Chinese, the People's Republic, the People's Bank of China chases markets. So I doubt that they'd be adding to their gold positions here. I highly doubtful of that. So who are the biggest players in this? Don't know. You know, and central banks, you know, when Dr. Faber talks about 2000, 2001, as he knows as well as anybody, the Bank of England basically disposed of all its gold, you know, with the brilliance of Gordon Brown who was Eddie George. So they got rid of it. Mark Carney, as the governor of the Bank of Canada back in 08, 09, he sold off the Canadian gold because he thought it was too volatile to be a reserve asset. So, you know, there are so many different mindsets. Who's buying here? I don't know. But as Dr. Faber talks about when they were talking about it, and we talked many times, and I think Dr. Faber and I going back 3 or 4 years when we did some podcasts, we would talk about real yields were going up and yet gold was not correcting. And overnight real yields are usually death for the gold market. But it couldn't really correct. It would come down $100, $200, maybe three. But there was no major, major correction. And if there's a legacy to Paul Volcker taught you that if you wanted to cure high gold prices, squeeze the financing markets with high real yields, right? He rose back in 70, 81, real yields in the United States rose dramatically. We're not close to that. In fact, I'd probably argue let's use their numbers because we don't have anything else. So maybe we're at a real yield of overnight money. I'm not talking about the long end. I'm talking about overnight money of 1%, maybe. And you heard Jerome Powell finally got asked a question at the last press conference. Of course, out of 20 questions, it was the 19th question, and it was on gold. The second part was on gold. You can go back and listen to it. And it was a terrible answer. But Peter Buchvar beautifully put out a day or two later the interchange between Ben Bernanke, I know Dr. Favre's favorite person, and Ron Paul, going back to 2011, 2012, a 15-minute question and answer on gold. And Bernanke was so classically Eastern establishment economist talking about the metals. And they hate the metal. You know what? What did they, if you, they, you know, they couldn't cite Keynes enough. You know, they don't really cite Keynes about what, when Keynes talks about repudiation of debt and devaluation, that they don't want to talk about. But call it a barbarous relic, it rolls off their tongue like that's all they talk about before they go to bed at night. That's all they talk about. But there is a role for it. And central bankers just, they don't pay, nobody asks them. It's amazing how stupid the media is. And stupid, lazy, and arrogant, because they know everything, because, you know, most of them went to highline schools, and they will not engage on this gold. And yet, everybody talked about Powell, find your inner Volcker. Well, he can't find his inner Volcker, because Paul Volcker, because of his role in advising Nixon in 1971, but Paul Volcker disdained gold as a central banker. And he would, around the edges, talk about that gold was his enemy as a central banker, because it would send you a signal that, wait a minute, in a fiat currency world, you're not doing very well. So, but, you know, what are you going to have to do? But they're not interested in that. They're not interested. Central bankers today, from the G30 on down, they're just not interested in it. They're interested in keeping the quote-unquote financial system intact. And I would call that the adherence to that, the Bernanke doctrine, because the Bernanke doctrine ensured that the global financial world would not go into a debt deflation. They fear that more than they fear inflation. And to say otherwise, they're lying through their teeth. That's their greatest fear. And that's what, to me, the gold market has told us, that because of that, the central banks have totally lost, or I won't say lost, but they have greatly diminished credibility.
Yes, but partly because of Wall Street. Because Wall Street gets its money from asset values. And you talked about the debt deflation, the fear of debt deflation. Wall Street fears asset deflation. I mean, I just got a table today about commercial real estate prices. And Bill King actually wrote in his report today about the property that was sold for $4 million and a few years ago for $200 million. We're talking about a massive deflation in commercial property prices. And Trump and his donors, do you think they want to see stocks drop more than 10%? No, they'll do anything to support them, anything. And in my view, this will lead eventually to more inflationary pressures and a further depreciation in the purchasing power of paper monies, of all of them. Now, there are some that are better than others, but the US dollar would seem to me to be rather vulnerable because of their commitments that are unfunded. The unfunded liabilities of the U.S. have to be at the highest level ever. And about that, Wall Street doesn't like to talk either. But Wall Street will never criticize the Fed extensively because they live from money printing. The asset values go up, their profits go up. The asset values go down, their profits go down. As simple as that.
Mm-hmm. As a follow-on question on relating to gold, in the past you've mentioned platinum may surpass or reach the same levels as gold. Are you still of that view? And can you elaborate more on that view, why you believe that?
Yes, I think that platinum is very cheap. As I mentioned, in the case of oil, oil is very inexpensive compared to gold. The same is true of platinum. We are in the early stages of a major bull market, in my opinion, that will propel prices to a higher level than gold. But it's a volatile commodity because it's so thinly traded, isn't it? It doesn't take a lot of money to move it. I think someone will eventually manipulate the price into the sky. It hasn't happened yet, but it's performed adequately. And I think that if you don't own any precious metals at all and you want to start owning some, I would probably buy some platinum now, which in my opinion has less downside risk than some of the others.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
Interesting. What are your thoughts, Ira, on platinum? Well,
you know, the last time I think Dr. Faber and I were on together was May 14th of 2025, and we had an excessive, and platinum was trading $990, and we were talking about the same thing. Okay. Because... Yeah. Again, with what Dr. Faber talks about, are the precious metals a store of value? If you believe that they're a store of value and not just the industrial side, then platinum is phenomenally cheap on any historic metric. So I can't agree more. And we're certainly seeing, you know, with the EV craze, the electric vehicle craze, kind of, it's not that they're not making them, they are. But the hybrid world has certainly resuscitated itself. So those who were pushing that negative narrative, negative narrative on platinum because of electric vehicles, that's got to take a back seat because, and Dr. Faber's sitting in the center of it, the hybrid, the Japanese with the hybrids, still needs a large amount of platinum in those exhaust systems. So that is now back in the page. And then when you look historically of platinum to gold. Now, I'm not telling you to go out and buy platinum. As Dr. Faber says, it's a very thinly traded. It's not for the faint of heart. First of all, none of the metals in today's world are for the faint of heart. I've lived through a lot. I've traded through the hunts. So I've been through this, but this is beyond anything that I could have ever imagined. So I'm not telling you to run out and buy it, but look for a way for you to invest in it on any type of correction, because we're getting, you see all types of corrections. But I think that if you believe in precious metals, it's certainly a much better store of value than Bitcoin. That I'll attest to. Unless if I issued Bitcoin or if I issued like Tether, rather than Tether buying all that gold to support its stable coin, I would be loading the boat with platinum. And I'm surprised the Chinese, but it wouldn't, if we found out that the Chinese were starting to hoard platinum, wouldn't surprise me. And they used to make beautiful platinum pandas, by the way, great coins. Back in the day. I haven't seen one in a long time, but they were beautiful. So I can't agree with Dr. Faber more.
Yeah, interesting. And speaking of Japanese, if we look at Japan, Dr. Faber, what are your thoughts on, could we get an unwinding of the Japanese yen carry trade? What are the trends in the Japanese government bond market, the yields, any potential effects or impacts of that on the economy and the financial markets?
Well, of course, I observe the exchange rate, US dollar, yen, and in general, I think that the yen is not expensive compared to the US dollar, that it will appreciate. On the other hand, the government debt and the demographics are very poor in Japan, and therefore I can't get particularly optimistic about the country macroeconomically. Now, on the micro level, there are outstanding companies in Japan, but in general, as an investor, and I live in Asia and I invest principally in Asia, I prefer to invest in countries like Hong Kong, Singapore, Indonesia, Philippines, Thailand, Vietnam, China, than say in Japan. I think one of my major themes a year ago was that Hong Kong property stocks and Chinese stocks were very cheap, and some Chinese stocks have performed very well, and some Hong Kong companies have done fantastically well. I mean, they doubled last year and they are still not particularly expensive. So I kind of, my view is, if I sell my shares in Asia and my share portfolio yields say around 5% per annum dividend, what do I do with the money? Some people will tell me, Mark, you should invest in cash. But is cash safe? I'm not so sure. I mean, do you own a bank stock or do you have a deposit with the bank? I'm not entirely sure. In the 1950s, I would have said you can safely deposit money with a bank. But nowadays, I'm not so sure that this is a wise move to do. Do you, as a cash alternative, I would suggest maybe, and I'm thinking about this all the time myself, if I sell some stocks, should I buy more gold? I don't necessarily think that it's a very good idea from a capital gains perspective. But I also think that maybe gold in a crisis situation will go down less than the max 7 stocks in America. Let's put it this way. So we could be in a scenario where assets go down and an investor should look at assets that will go down, but they go down the least. And therefore, the investor who holds the assets that go down the least becomes relatively richer to investors that own the asset that go down the most. As Ira sort of implied, I would include cryptocurrencies in the assets that will go down the most. And the ones associated with Mr. Trump, the guaranteed go to zero. That is a fairly safe bet.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not the first time that Mr. Trump would run something into zero.
Right. Yeah. You into the Trump coin, Ira, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah. No, but okay. I love it. So, I mean, Dr. Faber's knowledge of the emerging markets is so vast, and I'm looking at them too. You know, and as we talked about with Louis Gavet, who's also really great with the emerging markets and understanding them. So, you know, are there? I still think on a relative basis, they're very cheap. I've been looking at from an energy perspective. Yesterday I bought Petrobras. I'm not buying a lot. I'm stepping my way into it because Brazil, as much as Brazil to me is a great story for many reasons, as Peter Buchvar reminded me yesterday in our conversation, they have elections coming in October that are going to be very important. How they play out with China is going to be very interesting. I'm looking at Canada only because I think Canada is so rich in what the world needs. And now that they've thrown off the yoke of Justin Trudeau, and at least Mark Carney's eyes are open in how to create wealth for Canada. So I think Canada is in a enviable position. I said it with Lewis, if I was Trump, I would take $100 billion and put it into and coax Mark Carney to do some sovereign wealth funds with the U.S. and secure a lot of that resources right north of the border, high quality, good producers, clean producers. It's got everything going for it, except that it's had such bad policies. But I think that they're changing. Yesterday was an interesting story, too, how conservative parliament members are actually switching to the Liberal Party enough so that Mark Carney might be able to get an absolute majority. So that gets interesting. And they're doing it because they see some of the underlying things going on. I sent this to you yesterday, Richard, and I want to hear Dr. Faber talk about it. You know, I've been looking at Vodafone, which has been like all the telecoms for the last 20 years. If you put up charts of AT&T, Verizon, they've been miserable companies because their companies who were in their flush with cash made a lot of bad decisions and then wound up taking on too much debt. But Vodafone has been correcting its debt situation. Yesterday, there was an article in the FT that they sold off part of their Dutch telecom holding, but their assets in Africa are huge, meaning how they're involved in the internet and in the telephone industry in Africa. So that has really great appeal to me because I think Africa, as again, it's one of those stories that has been waiting to happen. But with that type of infrastructure and that type of money that is earned there, I'm just looking at it. Again, I don't tout these things. I discuss these things. And if you find merit in it, go about your business and find where your risk tolerance is okay. I'm not sure about the technical picture. I know it's been improving a little bit. I own a little bit of it, but I am paying attention to it. So I would go back to Dr. Faber on this.
Thoughts on Vodafone, Dr. Faber, and Canada?
Sorry, I haven't followed Vodafone carefully, but I own some telecom stocks around the world. And specifically, I also own Petrobras and the preferred shares of Petrobras. Mm-hmm. And I own Brazilian banks. And I also own stocks in Colombia and Ecopetrol. I mean, the oil sector is inexpensive. And in Africa, Total is heavily involved, as well as British Petroleum. And the Chinese, I also own Chinese oil companies. They are on the embargoed list of the U.S., but they performed very well. I mean, any stock that has been sort of banned by the U.S. or listed as a state-owned enterprise has done very well over the last 12 months, including China Mobile, but more recently less. But say, concerning Vodafone, the telecom stocks in Europe have done well. Orange has gone up more than 50% in the last 3 months. So some life has come into the sector.
interesting. And what about Canada? Any thoughts? Any, you see any hope there for economic development and investment opportunities?
Yes, I think the policies that Trump has implemented towards Canada are suicidal. But nothing surprises me with politicians. And I also have to say, I like Canada, but I don't particularly like Mr. Carney. That is another subject. But better him than, say, the communist Greens like Trudeau. Trudeau was a complete disaster. Mm-hmm. And I'm surprised Canadians voted for him so often. And in my view, the Canadian dollar is inexpensive. And what Ira said about the resources is, of course, true. The resources of Canada are vast, enormous. But equally, the natives have a lot of power. And some of the mines are difficult to develop or will never be developed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are good points. Ira, you, any thoughts on Latin America emerging market opportunities? You know, Dr. Faber mentioned Brazil.
I think Dr. Faber, you know, especially as he's been involved, I know from his work, so many places, and especially in the banking, you know, we've talked about the banking industry around the world, not in the U.S. I don't own one U.S. bank at this juncture. I still own, Commerzbank, and it's been a very good play. Mitsubishi Tokyo, I still love, and I understand the shortcomings of Japan. But when I talk to people, they don't even understand, you know, and I'm talking about professionals. That now one of them realizes that Mitsubishi Tokyo owns 23% of Morgan Stanley because of what happened in 2008. They were the ones who wrote the check for Morgan Stanley.
Yeah.
And that could be such a powerful combination for wealth management in so many parts of the world. I do think that UBS, which is a bank I still own, really got themselves in order. They got it. They're still struggling with the Credit Suisse fallout, but they're back in the wealth management business. And I think they have the only reason I owned them is because their big footprint in Asia. And I think that footprint continues to grow. And once they get out of what's going on in Switzerland with the legality issues of Credit Suisse, they'll be back in a more powerful position. But I'm looking for value. What I determine to be value plays. I am not chasing these other things. If I miss, I'm not afraid of missing out where other people go. If I don't believe in it, even though it becomes a massive thing, a massive upside, it doesn't bother me. I also miss the South Sea bubble. So I miss the tulip mania. So, I don't have to be involved where everybody else is going. That doesn't do anything for me. I have to get to my comfort zone to find out from my global, the way I analyze global finance. One of the things, and I know we talk about it, but I got Dr. Faber, so we have to talk about it, is of course always Switzerland. And Dr. Faber all points out, it's not like the Swiss National Bank doesn't print money. They do, but they were just better at what they did with that money, buying equities rather than more sovereign debt or whatever else. and again, I look at them. If I'm running the SNB and what's his name, Schlegel, I would start moving assets to the areas that Dr. Faber and I talk about. Why aren't you buying natural resource companies in Canada? Why aren't you, you've been involved in, I think they're the third largest holder of Apple of all the shareholders. So they've been involved in a lot of these things, and smartly so. They've made a lot of money. So the S&P has done very well, but it's time to start moving around those assets, and especially because I think the Swiss currency is phenomenally overvalued relative to some things, but they're not overvalued when it comes to their sovereign debt issues. Because as bad as everybody else, and it's not to say that they're angels, they're not, but they're in such a much better position, which makes, in my mind, the Swiss franc a desired currency. I won't say valuable, desired currency, even though the Swiss would like a weaker currency. So I think it's time for them to get a little more aggressive in the world.
Your thoughts on that, Dr. Faber, for the Swiss National Bank and financial alchemy? Yeah.
Well, of course, I've been following the Swiss financial system for a long time because as a Swiss citizen, I hold a Swiss portfolio, which hasn't done exceedingly well, but it's done okay, currency adjusted vis-a-vis other currencies. And in Switzerland, we have an unusual situation. Say 10 years bonds, they yield exactly, let me see, they yield now 0.21%. Mm-hmm. So less than 0.5%, 0.25% for 10 years. And at the same time, the stock market, you have lots of companies, they have a dividend yield of, say, 4, 5, some even 6%. So the dividend yield is much higher than the fixed deposit yield, which is close to zero. And I think that the stock market is not particularly expensive. I own some blue chip companies and pharmaceuticals. And then we have an institution which is unusual in the world. It's called the Kantonalbanken. These are partly government-owned, but they're also listed banks. And they got into trouble in the mid-1990s, but now they're relatively clean. And a lot of people had money with Credit Suisse, and they don't like to have the money now with UBS, or they want to diversify. So some money that used to be or was transferred from Credit Suisse to UBS is now leaving UBS and going into the Kantonalbank system. And these Kantonalbanks, they yield, say, 4%. So 4% compared to 0.21% is a very high yield. And that's why I feel reasonably comfortable with my Swiss stock portfolio. And then we have lots of companies. They're good companies. Quality-wise, they're very conservative. But because of the global economy, they're not doing particularly well at the present time. And also in manufacturing. And this, I mean, everybody has to live with the fact what China touches is coming under incredible competitive pressures because China is very efficient in manufacturing. They're not what people think, they're producing Nike shoes and so forth and cheap goods. They have brands and they have power because their domestic market is so big. So in manufacturing, they're incredibly competitive. I mean, they make cars that are of superior quality than BMW and Audi and Mercedes, and they sell them for half the price.
This
also relates to other products. So I'm very careful about the manufacturing sector in Asia. In general, I think that, say, a manufacturer in Thailand, I don't think he has a chance to outdo a Chinese company. Now, some, they own the land in Thailand, and this is a competitive advantage the country has. The fertility of the land is incredibly high. So they are competitive in food production. And this is a theme I would look at for the next 10 years. I think the world will have several food crises. And we talked, Ira, about Bungi and so forth, you know, the traders of food. And I still think this important subject to own companies that produce food. Now, as you know, a lot of food that was produced is poisonous. But some companies will adjust and produce food that is desirable. And I think small farms may make a comeback. Who knows? But I would have an exposure to food companies, and there, Latin America is second to none.
Yeah, that's very true.
Actually, it's not true that they're second to none. The most productive in agriculture is the U.S.
Okay, great. And just before we go back to Dr. Faber for his final thoughts, what your final thoughts, Ira?
Yeah, I'm glad Dr. Faber brought that up, because every time we've talked over the last 3 or 4 years, the podcast that we've done, we've talked about Bungi, and it's been such an interesting play. And because, as Dr. Faber points out, their footprint in Latin America is huge. Where ADM and others moved away, you know, what was it, the Five Sisters? What were the grain companies called? It was Bungi, Conti, ADM, Cargill. They were enormous. But Bungi has such a huge presence down in Latin America. And Latin America becomes more and more important, not just because of Uruguay, because of Venezuela. That's a whole different sidetrack. But we'll see how the election turn out. But I think that food footprint is huge. And again, I'm not telling you, well, Dr. Faber and I have talked about this. So I've owned Bungi since 2020 and 2021, when I thought that the Chinese were busy during COVID stockpiling all types of raw materials and agricultural products. So I thought that their footprint and being in that. So it's been right, but it's an up and down. But the dividend is solid, and their footprint is so big. But outside of that, you know, I can't say enough. To sit and talk with Dr. Faber and be able to discuss these things is the culmination of a great career to me, that this puts it in, because I've been reading Dr. Faber since I bought my first Barron's, which was probably 1976 or 77. And I've really paid great attention to him. And he's meant a lot in my career as far as opening my eyes to all the things I don't know, which is probably the best thing you could be in. And with the gloom and doom report, I've read it. Him, bank credit analyst, and my friend Jim Sinclair for so many years until he taught me so much. So I say a giant thank you.
Yes, likewise as well. And your final thoughts, Dr. Faber, on...
Well, your viewers shouldn't believe Ira. He grossly exaggerates.
Yeah.
And in our business, you know, sometimes you get something right and sometimes something wrong. And we should remain modest in life.
Yes.
And this is my view. But my final thought is, if I look at myself, because of the appreciation of assets, I've become reasonably affluent. And as a Christian, I somehow feel bad about that, because I didn't do anything for it. I have more affinity or more justification for anything that I worked for to earn. but to earn it through capital gains and so forth is not necessarily my idea of a good time, because I realize that it makes the rich people incredibly rich, and the majority of people that don't have significant assets, it actually sets them back, relatively speaking, in terms of purchasing power of their money. Now, for the first time, I feel reasonably wealthy. And the question arises, you know, what do I do with my stocks and with my gold and precious metals holdings and real estate and so forth and so on? And I sort of come to the conclusion that we are all vulnerable to a setback in assets. I mean, wealthy people, they own their homes, but they also own commercial properties, and they own stocks, and they own bonds, and they own some precious metals, and they own cryptos, and God knows what. But a lot of these things are vulnerable. I mean, my stock portfolio is, say, at 100. It could easily go to 120, but it could equally go down to, say, 80 or 70 or 50. And psychologically, I have to say, I feel happier to wake up in the morning and having an asset value that goes up than an asset value that goes down. So I'm just thinking loud, how would I react if for, say, 2 or 3 years in a row, my assets, instead of appreciating, and as expected by most people, would be depreciating? And I think each investor should sit in front of the mirror and ask himself the question, psychologically, I'm prepared to see my asset values go down, because we live in a world where, in the Western world, in America, say, most people have had rising asset values over their lifetime, especially after World War II. So people are conditioned to their portfolios appreciating, but it may come to an end at some point. And my view is it has come to an end in real terms. In other words, the Fed and other central banks, they can print money and stocks go up, but they go up less than precious metals. And then the purchasing power goes down. And for the majority of people, the standards of living are down from a few years ago or from their parents' time. That even the Fed has in their statistics, that the standards, that the purchasing power of money has been depreciating. And how this will be resolved will be interesting, especially under the rule of a president who is incredibly ignorant individual who intervenes into everything, because he's convinced he knows better than anybody else in the world. And this is a very dangerous man. I would have voted for him any time, and still today, compared to what the Democrats are serving in the form of a Kamala Harris and so forth. But nonetheless, I'm saying he's a dangerous individual.
Yeah, I think, as the saying goes, the more the state plans, the more it's difficult for the individual, right, to,
yes,
to plan, yeah. Okay, it's been very insightful and very much value your historical perspective as well. Words of wisdom. Thank you so much, Dr. Farber.
Thank
and
you.
Ira. And Jed, if you can put up your contact details.
Thank you.
Also.
Thank you, Dr. Farber.
Thank you, Jed. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
All right.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.